Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 55. Oh, I did it backwards again. My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And this is episode number 55. So, we're a little discombobulated, but we have officially moved out of the apartment.
Yes.
We are each in our own places.
Yes.
Everything's a mess, but that's fine. That's fine.
But our schedules should get a little more settled and a little more even-keeled now.
Yeah, less chaotic.
We thought that last week was going to be the beginning of things getting back to normal, but the cleaning began, and it totally, we underestimated how long cleaning the apartment was going to take.
Like, vastly underestimated it. We should have known better at this point in our lives, but it's
I've cleaned
fine.
Enough places. I should have known, but I totally thought we had it. Anyway, it's done now, so we should be able to get on back on our normal schedule. So thank you for hanging in there.
And I went on a little road trip for Halloween weekend, driving like 7 hours each way. I didn't drive because I'm lucky, but... So, like, I was gone, which is why we didn't record earlier and why we're putting out this episode a little bit late. So, it's already been Halloween, which is my favorite holiday, and it was kind of fun. Covered myself in fake tattoos, and now I'm really itching to get real ones, but it was a good time. Did you do anything special? Did you have trick-or-treaters?
Not really. Yesterday, because Halloween was yesterday, basically. 2 days ago.
Two days ago already.
It was actually my boyfriend's mother's birthday, so he went out to dinner for her birthday, and I was working, so we turned the light off and made sure that nobody came to our door.
Yeah.
We didn't have candy anyway,
really?
But, because we just hadn't gotten around to it.
Yeah.
But, so I was working, so I was kind of locked in my office, just typing away, but...
That's no fun.
It is what it is.
I'm sure you're happy we're post-Halloween, though, because that's...
Basically means it's Christmas season.
Yeah, which I disagree with. This is one of the fissures in our relationship, is I am a very big Halloween person. She is a very big Christmas person. We try to meet in the middle, but...
Right, and I mean, Thanksgiving, it exists, it's there. I appreciate it for what it is, but it's basically just an impediment to Christmas. So... Like, it's there, and I'm happy to celebrate Thanksgiving, but before Thanksgiving, I'm basically in Christmas mode, and after Thanksgiving, I will remain in Christmas mode. So.
I'm not really a big Christmas person at all. Like, I'll wait until, like, December 1st. Like, if I don't hear any music until December 1st, I'm happy. Even after that, sometimes I'm like, look, but... That's a me thing.
Is it, you may be able to avoid it a little better these days.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Because I just like Christmas music and movies and all the things.
Yeah. But anyway, we're not talking about Halloween or Christmas today.
No, we are not.
We're talking about Procrusties, which should be very interesting and very different from Christmas, at least.
I was going to say, it sounds Halloween appropriate.
A little more Halloween appropriate, yeah. But first, we do have some news and all of that. If you would like to get into contact with us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. I just feel chaotic. Like, I'm just throwing things out willy-nilly. Comes to my mind is what comes out of my mouth today, apparently. But yeah, we do have some news and updates. I want to run through these pretty quick because we want to get through this main discussion and talk about the chapter, because I'm pretty excited about the chapter this week.
Agreed.
So, first and foremost, Reed Riordan put out not one, not two, but three articles this week. And they're actually all pretty interesting ones. So we have 7 terrifying monsters from the Rick Riordan Presents imprint. And it's got chupacabras, haints from the Tristan Strong series, vampires, of course. This one that I cannot pronounce from Pahua and the Soul Stealer. And then we've got Nurgle's demons from City of the Plague God. and some from Race to the Sun, and Ghosts from the Thousand World series by Yoon-Ha Lee. So some really good reading on here. I think it's very Halloween appropriate, so that's pretty exciting. And then we also got an article. I really liked this one. It was, What Do the Gods and Demigods Have Planned for Halloween? And it's got everyone from Clarice to Chiron to Piper to Hades to Grover, Athena, Eopatis, aka Bob, Tyson, Medea, Dionysus, Hades again, Athena again. So there's actually a really good mix of people in there.
Yeah, I mean, this is a cute idea, like, for an article.
Yeah.
Just kind of quickly running down what all of the gods and demigods would be doing. Yeah. Like, that's cute.
Pretty cool. And people had some really good Percy Jackson costumes. Did you see the little baby demigod one?
No, I missed it.
Rick retweeted it, I think a couple of days ago, and it was so cute. I think the caption was, is Riptide getting bigger or are these demigods getting smaller? Because it was literally an infant. It was so cute. Yeah.
Okay, I see it now.
But the last Reed Riordan article is Roseanne A. Brown and Sarwa Boateng answer your questions about vampire hunting, which, again, you can't get more perfect for
yeah.
Halloween. And I remember Roseanne being really excited on Twitter about being able to give Rick advice for vampire hunting, and I thought that was really cute. Next up, there was an Entertainment Weekly interview that looks like it was post D23, because I remember specifically Leah's outfit that she was wearing.
Yeah.
So I think they just released it now. And it has a lot of, you can tell they're like promoting the show right now with like what information they have. And I think if you've been following along, most of us have heard all of this already. It was like, oh yeah, we're going to be able to expand the story a little bit because of television. And they were kind of talking a little bit about their experiences and what the characters mean to them and how they found Percy Jackson. But the one thing that I really liked was Arian was talking about practicing how to walk as a goat. Like, apparently he has to walk on his tippy toes in order to walk like a goat. And he has, like, I think it's, like, going to be visual effects, but he must have something on his legs. Probably, like, the dots and stuff.
So they were, like, green screening or something. So that they can...
But he has to walk on the tips of his toes, and he has been practicing it a lot to the point where he'll be walking around, like, New York City or just walking around somewhere, and he'll catch himself walking on the tips of his toes, and he has to be like, oh, stop doing that. And I just thought it was a really cute
that
story.
That is really cute. Aww.
Yeah.
Goat walking.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. But I'll link to that. It's on YouTube, and it's not very long, like less than 10 minutes, I think. So if you just want to see them and see what they have to say, Rick was there too, then you can do that. We have another blog post.
He is just whipping the blog posts out right and left these days.
I mean, this has like almost been like one every week pretty much. So not that I'm complaining. I love getting the updates, but they're usually a little bit more to talk about.
Yeah.
They were filming some scenes at the Lotus Hotel and Casino, which is very exciting, I think, for everybody. And he said, you will know this part of the adventure well if you've read the books, but you will also find lots of fun details, new scenes, and Easter eggs that make the experience even better. And I think that this is a really perfect way to, like, put it, not just Nico and Bianca stuff, but, like, other little Easter eggs and, like, details and foreshadowing type of things. And just, like, I imagine it's gonna be a pretty big looking place with a lot of extras. So, like, they can throw in tons of details. I'm gonna wanna go through, like, the scene just to see everything we can find.
Yeah, no, for sure. This is one place where I feel like they can kind of have a little more fun and play a little looser and kind of add some random fun Easter egg-y kinds of things.
Yeah, definitely.
People will enjoy.
Rick was giving real-time commentary as he was writing this blog post, which I really enjoyed. He said, like, at one moment he looked up and Walker was clapping the slate, the thing that's, like, you know, cut or, like, action, that thing.
It's that black and white thingy that you always see.
Yeah. So he was doing that, and Leo was laughing. Then he looked up again, and he saw their stand-ins, both of which are, like, 25 years old. So it was, like, so interesting probably to go from, like, 12-year-old to, oh, that's a 25-year-old adult human being.
Yeah.
But they were standing in for them, which is cool. He commented on how they have to film a scene multiple times from multiple angles to make sure they have plenty of shots to choose from. Again, this wasn't really, like, information we didn't know, but I like when he shares, you know, he reiterates how long it takes to do all of this stuff. I think for people who are less familiar with how the industry works, like, it's just good to be reminded that, like, no, this takes a lot of time.
Yeah, I think that's also especially helpful because while a lot of us Percy fans are a little older, the intended audience for the books is younger. So there's a lot of, like, middle grade kids that are probably following all of this very closely, and they don't know
all the stuff that we do.
Right. Yes. So I'm sure it's especially exciting to hear it from Rick's mouth and, like, hear, like, yeah, we're doing a million different angles and making sure we've got everything we need so that when we go to edit the episodes, everything's there and we just have to piece it together.
Right.
And we don't have to go back out and try and shoot something or whatever. Like, that's all, it's all fun and new.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He also says that production is looking ahead to the end of the season now. The scripts are finished, but they will be changed many times. And he also reiterated that he reads every draft and has plenty of input. So he's really approving every single thing that is going into the show.
Nice.
He also talks about the director's cut, the producer's cut, and, like, everybody else who gets a cut of the show, and how they go back and forth, and that one episode can take a month to finalize, and that's even before they add in the special effects. So again, like, this just takes a lot of time.
Because everybody has a vision, like, the producers have an idea of what they want in an episode, and they have ideas of how they like things, and the director has a very specific vision, like, they have probably the most direct vision. Like, when I was filming it, I wanted this and this and this. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Rick, who says, well, this probably should be seen because you're going to need to see that, like, down the road, or this is a really important scene, or, you know. So, yeah, I'm sure with at least the three of them, if not more people, all kind of chiming in, it definitely makes for a complicated process.
Yeah, and it must be so interesting for TV directors who are only there for an episode or two and are probably aware of what happens the rest of the show, but really their handprints are only on, like, for example, those first two episodes, and then it's left to somebody else. So, like, they have a vision for the beginning, but Rick has an overall view of what the entire season's going to look like a little bit better than the director will. So, like, he's got to make sure that it all kind of matches. I think that's fascinating to think about.
Yeah, the showrunner on a TV show like this, the showrunner is almost more, they're the most important guiding force to make sure everything looks the same, because the directors do come in, you know, do one-off episodes or whatever. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. He also talked about other film projects that he's got going on. So they just turned in the newest draft of The Red Pyramid. It's not quite ready to move into production just yet, but this is a good, you know, next step in the process. He specifically talked about how, like, yes, they've been working on this script for 2 years at this point, and even though it's not ready, you know, that's fine. And with a film, like, you need that whole script to be ready versus the TV show where, like, they were still writing things a little bit while they were moving into production, because you have more time to do that sort of thing. But
yeah, they'll probably still be rewriting stuff even in the movie, but it will be closer to a locked draft.
Right.
That's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah, so he said that he was very happy with this draft. Everything's moving in a good direction, so
you
just gotta be patient. And then Aditi Kapil is currently working on her draft of Daughter of the Deep. He doesn't know when he's gonna get that back yet, so that's still moving along, which is very good. And then Rick is also working on a potential series format document, a Bible, to bring Finn McCool to television based on my story, My Life as a Child Outlaw. Very early days on this project, but I will let you know more details when and if the series finds a home. And I think we had heard that this had been optioned, but we hadn't really, like, gotten any details about it.
Yeah.
So basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, basically what he's doing is kind of writing, like, the overall idea for the season and, like, the beats that it would have to hit and stuff, but then somebody else would probably come in and write. They would break each episode down, and, like, whether or not he's involved involved in that process, we don't know yet because it hasn't found a studio or a streaming platform or anything yet. So.
Yeah, it sounds like, yeah, he's just gathering all of the necessary information, anything that, because, like, it's not like Percy where you've got 10 books to look at, mm-hmm. you know. For Finn McCool, it's a very small amount of information that Rick actually has written down that we've read, like, right. that we've had access to. I'm sure Rick probably has notes, but kind of putting together one big document for a screenwriter to maybe take it on and start working it into a series or a movie or whatever. Yeah, he's probably just kind of compiling all of his thoughts and getting everything collected and starting to, yeah, work through things that would be major episode beats and stuff like that. So, yeah. Especially now that he's got a little more experience with writing for television
and
writing for film, I'm sure it makes it a little easier to kind of understand the things that would make good scenes or the things that would make good episode breaks, and so he's probably working on stuff like that.
Yeah, which is pretty exciting, because especially with how violent this was and the way that we saw Finn McCool, like, grow up over the years, I really feel like it could make a good longer series, it could make a good limited series, and it could even end up being for a little bit, like, maybe more, like, YA audiences, too, like, if they decide to go in that direction.
Yeah.
So we'll just have to see how it changes. Probably, you know, several years out from that actually yeah. being on our screens, but
that's for sure.
We have a lot going on in between, so it's fine.
Because when you look past all of the other projects, he's also writing.
Yeah, and we've got some major books coming up, and yeah, there's just a ton going on. But that's cool. Speaking of the writing projects, though, that was a good toss to me, that transition.
I did.
Chalice of the Gods will be novel length, but it will be closer to the original books than the longer Heroes of Olympus and Trials of Apollo books, which I feel like I'm okay with. Because this is an in-between story, I don't really feel like it has to be this giant tome. You know, we're just kind of filling in the gaps, and it's not, like you said several times, a world-ending scenario.
Right.
It's just trying to get into college. So I think it'll be fun to keep it on a little bit shorter side, but I'm still happy that it's not like a novella. It's going to be a full-length book.
Yeah, agreed, yeah.
And I thought this was really cute. He's hoping the kids on the show will be his beta readers.
I'm sure they will.
They'd
be more than happy to beta read for you, Rick.
Yeah.
Especially Walker. I mean, yeah. They all are, but with Walker having been like a really big Percy fan before, like, I'm sure he would lose his mind to be a beta reader.
Yeah. He also gives us an update on his Italian and Irish lessons, which was pretty cool. I like when he updates us on that stuff. And if you want to check out everybody's Instagrams, you can see what they dressed up for as Halloween. I thought it was pretty cute, some of the costumes they chose. And Becky was tweeting out, like, what the crew members were dressed as. There was somebody dressed as a safety cone directing people going to places. Yeah, I thought it was really funny.
Love it.
Okay, so we're jumping right into our discussion for this week. Like I said, we're doing a monster guide on Procrustes, and this is somebody in the Percy Jackson books that I never really stuck out to me. Like, I remembered Echidna, I remembered Medusa, I never really remembered Procrustes, and I didn't really know anything about him. Luckily, there isn't too much to know about him. It's pretty straightforward, and what we see in the books is a pretty good representation of who he is in the mythology. But according to Percy Jackson's Greek Heroes, Theseus was the one who dealt with Procrustes. He was on his way to Athens when he basically decided to stop for the night, and he came across a hotel. Like, that's how Percy described it, but, like, whatever the back then version of a hotel was, like
some sort of inn
lodging,
sort
of thing. But inside there were only two beds. One was 10 feet long and the other was 4 feet long. So obviously Theseus is like, well, this is kind of weird. And then Procrustes kind of comes out of the back, and he has a huge leathery head with no hair, and he wore a full-length black leather apron, like what a blacksmith or a butcher would wear.
Why do I have, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
I mean,
like, that's
a little bit.
Like, I'm picturing him with a chainsaw on his hand. I know that's not right,
Maybe more like an axe.
Right.
I think it was maybe a double-sided axe maybe he had or something. Yeah. And Procrustes literally means the stretcher, so very appropriate, I feel like. And his whole shtick was that he got people to lay down in the beds, and then he would, like, cut them to size or stretch them to size, depending on which bed they chose. Theseus tricked Procrustes into laying down on the short bed to prove that it was comfortable, and then knocked him out, strapped him down, and lopped off his head and legs.
Blech.
And then spent a very nice night in the 10-foot bed. So, and then kept going on to Athens.
At least he's smart. He didn't, like, stretch him and then was stuck in the 4-foot bed all night.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a smart hero.
Yeah. So that was literally it from Percy Jackson's Greek Heroes. There wasn't a whole lot going on there, so I decided to look up some other information on just the Wikipedia page, like the normal Wikipedia page, and I came up with some fun facts too, because I feel like we always like those a lot.
Oh, yes.
But from the Wikipedia page, Procrustes was basically a rogue smith and a bandit from Attica who invited travelers to spend the night and then attacked people by stretching them or cutting off their legs so as to force them to fit the size of an iron bed. And I thought it was interesting because this feels like it could have been a real person. Like, he was supposedly a son of Poseidon, but also that could have been some legend that grew out of, like, some serial killer, like, some person who was just doing this to people.
Yeah.
Or a way to, like most mythological stories, warn you against maybe, like, don't go into creepy inns where there's somebody who looks like he wants to chop you up, like...
Or children, when it's time for bed, stay in your bed.
Yeah,
if you exactly. dangle your limbs off, Procrustes may come and mop them off. I mean, that sounds really intense, but... I mean, monsters under your bed. It's not that far of a road from telling children there's a monster under your bed, stay in bed all night. It definitely leads there.
Yeah, it fits. Here are some fun facts I found, though. So, Procrustean describes situations where an arbitrary standard is used to measure success, while completely disregarding the obvious harm that results from the effort. So you can really see, like, where that definition comes from according to the myth. So it's like you just randomly decide, okay, this is what means you win, regardless of, like, how it hurts people or, like, even if it doesn't make any sense.
So when my brothers are rude and make up rules that mean I lose, I can now tell them that their Procrustean efforts will not win the day.
I
will sound so smart and they will sound so dumb.
That would be so excellent.
Right?
I mean, the risk there is that they don't understand what you're saying and they just try to beat you up or something. But, yeah.
That's all right. They're just brothers.
Like, yeah. I would love if somebody used this in real life on somebody who was, like, you know, their parent who is, like, trying to get them to do something or, like, you know, you have to do all of these things before I take you to Disneyland or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
I think that would be hilarious.
Right.
So, in pop culture, Edgar Allan Poe used this term in The Purloined Letter as well from 1844, which I am not familiar with.
It's not something I'm really familiar with.
It's one of his short stories, but I thought this was really interesting. So Thomas Jefferson used it to argue for religious freedom. Basically, he used it as a way to say, like, it's really dangerous to have everything and everyone be uniform. You want people to have different ideas and to come at things from a different way. Not only will it be boring, but, like, literally dangerous if everybody is doing the same thing all the time and thinking the same way all the time. And I was like, you know, not that we should be rooting for Thomas Jefferson. I just always picture David Diggs, and I'm like, yeah, go Thomas Jefferson, yeah. But that's not the real Thomas Jefferson.
The historical figure definitely has some
flaws.
Yes. Well, a historical figure, he also has issues, so we acknowledge his issues, but also, this is a good argument, though. I like the thought process of that. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Now, I know we hate math.
We do.
We really hate math, but statistics and computer science have phrases relating to this concept as well. So in statistics, basically, instead of, like, gathering your data points and drawing a line through them to see, like, you know, what the average is, you basically draw a line and then pick and choose the data points to, like, meet the line. So you can see why that would be bad.
And you can also see how it kind of, like, picking and choosing what goes on is kind of like lopping off the head and the legs.
Yeah, like you make it fit.
It's like in figure skating when you get all of these scores and then they lop off the highest and the lowest ones.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of that same...
That's so Procrustean.
Right? That's what I'm saying.
And in computer science, it had something to do with, like, padding the code with spaces or something like that. I wasn't, like, I didn't read that one super closely, but I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, you're not going to like this one either. Mm. But so Procrustes actually had a couple of alternative names, and one of them was Damastes, I think, roughly is how you say that, which is also a type of East African huntsman spider.
Nope.
Now, I looked it up,
and
I thought it was pretty fuzzy and cute, but it is a huntsman spider, and those things get big.
I was going to say, is it the size of a dinner plate? Because if we're anywhere near there, I don't care how fuzzy it is.
I was trying to figure out, like, why it was named that specifically. Like, if it had really long legs or, like, really short stubby legs or something. Couldn't really, like, see why it was named that, but...
I mean, if it, you know, we kind of read up above that he was kind of a rogue and a bandit. Mm-hmm. So, like, I wonder if maybe it comes from that.
More of that.
Because, like, we've seen spiders be named after things, you know, like bandit spiders or whatever. Like, I've heard phrasing like that before. So I'm curious if maybe that might have something to do with it.
I couldn't remember where Attica was, which is where he's from. But that's literally, like, the Athens area and stuff like that. And I was like, is that in West Africa?
Like, no, maybe. It's not. No.
Oh, East Africa. Sorry. Okay. And so this piece of information I found particularly interesting. Apparently, Tim Oss was supposed to play Procrustes in the movie, which obviously we never got Procrustes.
Yeah.
But they changed his part to one of the janitors in the Parthenon replica with the Hydra instead, which, you know, disappointing. But, like, they had originally planned to put Procrustes in there. And I see for the movie specifically why they chose not to. I think, like, just moving things along, it did make sense for them to do what they did, but...
If you were going to eliminate one of, like, the monsters from that story, Procrustes makes the most sense because it's kind of the briefest, it's the most succinct... It's not vital to the story, so I can definitely see why.
And instead, they, you know, got rid of two monsters and replaced one with the Hydra.
But there's always a chance we may see Procrustes this time around.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely think we will, which will be super interesting, and I'm very excited to see, one, what he looks like, if they'll make him more human-like or more, like, monster-looking, and also just seeing, like, Walker chop off his head and go about his day will be hilarious and disturbing.
For some crazy reason, because it's like a bed sales store, you know, my brain has him dressed as a clown. I know it has something to do with the Krusty.
Krusty, yeah.
And so my brain keeps picturing him as, like, this ugly, like, dirty clown who's trying to sell beds. And, yeah, so we'll see what he looks like, but that's what my brain keeps telling me, and I'm like, it's not Krusty the clown, you weirdo. It's different. It's different.
That's funny. Okay, so in Percy Jackson itself, Procrustes is the owner of Krusty's Waterbed Palace, which, again, is probably where you're getting the clown thing from, which is a mattress shop in Los Angeles. In the book, he is 7 feet tall, he has no hair and gray leathery skin, thick eyes, which I didn't really know what that meant. Like, they didn't say eyebrows, they said, like, eyes.
Well, I wonder if maybe they're, like, cloudy. Like a snake, or, like, if he's got...
He's supposed to be kind of reptilian.
Yeah, because, like, if they're like, really dark, or you can see that the irises are, like, really thick to protect the eye. Because, like, on a lot of reptiles, because their eyes are exposed so often and for so long, they don't blink that often, so their eyes have a thicker...
Yeah,
lens to him. So that might be what they meant.
A cold reptilian smile and yellow teeth, so he's not winning any beauty contests, but it's fine. This is my favorite part, though. He wears a silk paisley shirt, unbuttoned halfway down, revealing his hairless chest, a velvet jacket with wide lapels, and many silver chains around his neck. This is somebody that I picture running a mattress shop in Los Angeles. Like, stereotypical used car salesman kind of looking dude. And it's just, like, the paisley shirt unbuttoned halfway down with the velvet jacket. Please, for the love of all that is holy, keep that in the show. Like, I want to see somebody dressed up exactly like that. And I keep picturing, like, a purple velvet jacket, too.
I keep seeing purple, too. Yeah. I don't know why. Maybe it's just a thing.
Yeah, it's just like...
For some reason, purple velvet is just like...
Although, if they went with, like, green velvet, that would be uglier.
I was seriously thinking the same thing. I was like, if they go with, like, a really dark green or something, they could also do... Yeah.
Yeah. That would be so
funny. That's
funny.
That's just funny.
So, in this myth, in the book, all of his beds were exactly 6 feet, and if you didn't fit, he'd stretch you to death or chop off your legs, which I found interesting because, like, 6 feet is not uncommon. Like, a 10-foot bed, obviously nobody's going to fit that.
Right.
And a 4-foot bed, I guess children would, or if you were very short, but like, you know, 6-foot bed is not that uncommon. But I guess even if you're an inch off, maybe he'd like chop off a pinky toe or something like
right.
that.
Right.
Yeah. And Percy thought he seemed nice at first, allowing them to hide from the people chasing after them. While Annabeth and Grover were ensnared, Percy tricks Procrustes into lying down in his own bed and then chops his head off, much like Theseus did in the mythology. So this one really stuck closely
yeah.
to what the original myth was, which I thought was pretty cute. And, you know, Procrustes, Theseus and Percy are all sons of Poseidon, so they're all half-brothers, technically.
Yeah, I was thinking that, too. It was like, well,
very awkward.
They're definitely, yeah.
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 But yeah, like I said, that was actually a very quick little monster guide, but it was interesting. I found, like, learning about the other stuff, the fun facts, was a little more interesting because the myth is so straightforward, but at least we have some foundation for that now, and
yeah.
when we see it in the show, we'll get to remember this episode, and it'll be great.
And everyone can start using Procrustean
yes.
as a descriptor when you come across a situation that warrants it.
Yeah. Okay, should we jump into The Last Olympian?
I think we should, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this week we read Chapter 9, Two Snakes Saved My Life. Percy is suddenly racing through New York City in a taxi with Mrs. O'Leary chasing behind, calling Annabeth and getting everything ready for his big plan, which, when we left him in the last chapter, involved finding Luke. Anyway, his second call gets an answer from Annabeth, and she and a bunch of campers are on their way to meet him at the Empire State Building. Shortly after Percy and Mrs. O'Leary arrive, so do all three white camp vans, bringing 40 campers in total to the city. Percy waits for Chiron to disembark the van, then asks him to lead the way to Olympus. But the centaur refuses, insisting that Percy lead the way, since he's the one who called all of them there. Percy marches into the lobby and escorts the first half of the campers in the elevator to the 600th floor. 40 campers, 2 elevator rides. I guess that tracks. Oh, and Stayin' Alive was playing in the elevator. The gods have a sense of humor. The doors open and a path of floating stones form a sky bridge that reaches to the streets of Olympus, and in the distance, the Palace of the Gods. Percy notices as they pass through the city that all the shops and houses are closed up, with just a few people kind of hanging around. The demigods keep walking right into the throne room, where the only beings present are the Ophiotaurus, hi Bessie, who is mooing happily at Percy as he approaches, and Hestia. Hestia can sense the change in Percy now that he's bathed in the River Styx, and she warns him to be wary of his weaknesses, and gives him a vision of the past. He sees the day that Luke and Talia found Annabeth. He watches as Luke reassures Annabeth that they're going to be her family now and gives her a knife to defend herself with. Then the vision flashes forward and we see the trio running through the woods a week or so later, only stopping when May Castellan's house, Luke's former home, is in sight. He's going to go steal some food and medicine and then they're going to be back on their way. But before he can take more than a step, there's a golden flash and a man's voice booms, "You should not have come home." Percy's knees buckle as he comes out of the vision and Annabeth catches him. He looks to Hestia and is about to ask to see Zeus when that same voice from the vision can be heard from next to Hestia. Hermes makes himself visible and Hestia leaves. Hermes informs them that while it may appear that Olympus has been left unguarded, it actually is surrounded by magical wards as well as minions of Aeolus, King of the Winds, who will not allow anything to enter Olympus from the air. The only entrance available is the elevator the Half-Bloods just rode up in. Hermes also mentions that Athena wanted to come back to Olympus to talk to the Half-Bloods herself, but decided on sending a message with Hermes instead. She wants them to know that they are on their own. The demigods will have to hold Manhattan without the help of the gods, as they have their own battle to wage against Typhon. Oh, and she also mentioned trying Plan 23. Whatever that means, Annabeth got it, though, and her face paled. That can't be good. Athena had one last tidbit to share. She told Hermes to remind Percy to remember the rivers and to stay away from her daughter. Hermes and Annabeth get into a bit of a shouting match about who is to blame for Luke's evil turn, and Percy shouts at the god. Percy's only spared Hermes' wrath because of his bath in the River Styx. Hermes tells Percy, He is in the hands of the Fates now. The messenger god then shifts into his godly form and disappears, and Annabeth starts to cry at the foot of her mother's throne. They have a brief back and forth before Percy reminds her about Plan 23, and Annabeth consults Daedalus' laptop. The plan involves a lot of the genius's inventions. Just then, the Stool brothers run up, warning Percy that something is going on. The entire island of Manhattan is asleep, passed out in the streets and on the sidewalks and everywhere. Percy recalls Grover's meeting Morpheus in Central Park, and he instantly knows that the invasion has begun.
For, like, the middle of this book, this feels very climactic.
It does.
And I think you're meant to feel that way. Like, Percy's going off to challenge Luke. It feels like it could be the end of the story. But since we still have half a book left, you know something's going to go wrong in the meantime.
And you know that, like, this is kind of a climax. It's the build-up to the battle. And the battle itself is going to have its own, like, climaxes and resolutions. So, like, it's one of the climaxes of this book. And it just feels so odd to be at this point and you're only halfway in the story.
I'm very worried.
Yeah, no, I mean, as we should be. But yeah, it does feel so early to already be building up to, it's time to find Luke, let's go! Like, yeah. But we're there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love how the end of the last chapter has him basically saying, I need to find Luke, and he's in the underworld. And then you start this chapter, and he's already in New York. He's racing in a taxi with Mrs. O'Leary behind him, and, like, it's just on the move. Like, we don't even know what Percy's plan is.
Right.
We just know that he's already enacting his plan, and that the campers are on their way, and Camp Half-Blood's been left unguarded. And, like, you know, it's just kind of racing forward, which I feel like is kind of where we're at. Like, we're getting so close to the battle, and we've been building up to it this whole time, but now it's just full speed ahead.
Yeah, definitely. I found it very interesting that Percy, well, not bad, like, Percy calls Annabeth, and I'm like, oh, yay, finally, because she's felt very absent from the book so far. And I think that's on purpose to kind of isolate Percy a little bit more. But it does feel a little disappointing because she's, I mean, aside from Titan's curse, she's been there every step of the way throughout the other books. And so whenever they're separated, and the fact that they're mad at each other doesn't help, I'm just, like, a little disappointed. But I think that the back half of the book will make up for that. But as of right now, I'm like, where's Annabeth?
Yeah, and
he's Annabeth.
He had to spend some time with Nico, and because of that, yeah, Annabeth's been MIA.
She couldn't be there because that would have changed the whole progress of events with Nico, but it's still,
yeah,
still a little frustrating.
I think also that feeling might be a little bit on us only doing one chapter at a time, because it feels like it's been so much longer since we saw Annabeth. Whereas if we had been doing two chapters, we'd be close to done with the book.
That's true.
And I feel like it may not have felt so long. So just something to keep in mind. Since we've slowed down a bit, I think it will feel like it's been so long since we saw Annabeth.
That's a really good point. And we had to take a couple weeks off, too. So it's been like, what, 2-3 months probably since we started this book?
Because we're
on chapter 9.
Yeah.
And we had to...
We took a couple weeks with Roseanne and
Yeah, so it's, close to that.
It's been a while.
Yeah. I also had another question about Annabeth while we're talking about her. So she has her laptop bag with her, and we know that this is the bag with Daedalus's computer. But, like, did it ever address the fact that, like, this is technology and that it could attract monsters? Or do you think Daedalus's laptop is, like, different? Or was it only cell phones? Like, do we know?
I mean, when we first start the Percy books, they make it sound like it's all technology. So I don't think it's just phones particularly. But my brain never even questioned it. I just assume that since Daedalus has put all of his stuff on this laptop, that it's different. That either maybe it's because it spent so much time in the labyrinth that, like, it's innocuous, like, it doesn't attract monsters because it spent so much time being around monsters.
Or he just built it that way because he's a demigod, so, like, he would know better.
Right.
And if he's trying to hide in the labyrinth, then he's going to make something that isn't going to draw more attention to him.
Right. I mean, I think basically because it's the best way to organize his plans and all of his inventions. I think he found a way to make it so that it wasn't the kind of thing that's going to attract attention. Yeah. I don't know how, but I think he would be the only person I would trust with that sort of mission.
I don't really need an explanation of how, just like, you know, the idea that it would still make sense canonically, I'm happy with that.
Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of how I thought too. That basically gets us to the Empire State Building and to the camper's arrival. And there's a couple of things to note with this part of the story. First of all, Chiron refuses to go to Olympus unless he's invited. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's very interesting. Like, not that it really gives you any major red flags. I think Chiron does it that way because that way the gods don't see him as intrusive ever. Like, if they want to talk to him, he'll show up. But otherwise, he'll deal until he absolutely, you know, unless he absolutely can't think of any other way. And I don't think it's unintelligent. I think it's a smart way to deal with the gods.
Yeah, and considering that Kronos is his father, they might not want to...
Also, a good note.
You know, just in case they don't smite him on the spot.
Yeah. I also thought it worth noting that 40 campers arrive. Most notably absent, the entire Ares cabin.
Yeah.
And I mean, we knew that Clarice made the threat, but I don't think any of us truly believed she would hold true to it. But clearly, she's sticking to her word, and it just makes me... I mean, Percy kind of glances by it, and we'll get to this in favorite quotes because I liked this part. But he kind of glances by it and just kind of is like... He's clearly disappointed in Clarice, as we all kind of are, because there's things greater than the prize you didn't get, you know? And that's basically... She was upset because they weren't getting credit and they weren't getting the chariot, right? Yeah. And so it's just kind of frustrating that she's going to allow them to go into battle to save the world and save all of them, and she's going to hold her entire cabin back.
I'm weirdly okay with this for two different reasons. One, I feel like Clarice has a point that it's bigger than getting the chariot. It's about wanting respect. It's about being the children of Ares and kind of being locked in this box and like being looked at in a certain way. And I think Clarice is way more three-dimensional than she could have been if she was just a daughter of Ares. So I get where she's coming from. Is this the best time to do this? Absolutely not. But on the other hand, the other reason why I kind of like this is, and I honestly don't remember, but like, what if the Ares cabin is back at camp to defend camp when something else happens there? Like, maybe Luke and the others won't get away with what they're trying to get away with because Clarice ended up staying behind. Don't know if that's going to happen, but I think it would be pretty smart if it did. Very lucky if it did.
I definitely agree with you there.
Yeah.
It might not be the worst strategic plan. Okay, all right, we can admit. Even if I am still mad at her. Okay.
Yeah. Going back to Chiron really quickly.
Sure.
Him not going up there, you know, we kind of know why, but also he very clearly says, I'm not your leader. I'm just a trainer. Percy, you're the leader. And like all the kids are looking at him and stuff. And I thought this moment was really interesting because it seems purposefully rushed. All of a sudden he's thrust into this. He kind of realizes he is the leader. He's like, go, go, go. We got to get up to Olympus. We got to save Olympus. And he doesn't really take the time to like realize what this means, and it doesn't feel as momentous as it should be. And on the one hand, I was kind of like annoyed with that because I wanted it to be this bigger moment, but on the other, we're still only halfway through the book, and I don't think Percy realizes like the role that he stepped into yet. Obviously, he knows about the prophecy and he knows the role that he plays, but like there's going to be a bigger moment down the line where like he realizes the weight of everything.
Yeah.
And I think that it's okay that this moment is a little rushed because we know we're going to get that later on.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Yeah. It does feel rushed. This whole section where they're just, trying to get up there and figuring it out, and Chiron's just kind of like, go. Like, you're the leader. Go. Lead them. Like, it happens very quickly. And then we don't hear from Chiron again in the chapter. Like, it's not like he's waiting for them or waves or anything, you know. Like, it's just, that's the only bit we get. So,
yeah,
it is really, really fast, for sure. Okay, so that gets us to the demigods entering the Empire State Building, and Karen has a cute note on here that I'm going to let her discuss.
Thanks. So they go up to the security guard like they did before, and the security guard is reading a big black book with a flower on the cover, and that's got to be New Moon, right? From the Twilight Saga? Like, what else would it be? He was reading Harry Potter. You didn't catch that?
It didn't even occur.
Really?
Until you pointed it out, and I read your note last night, and I just started laughing, and I was like, oh my god, he was reading New Moon. Like,
yeah.
He was
reading Harry Potter before, he's reading New Moon now. I feel like it's really funny that this security guard, who's clearly not entirely human, like,
right.
can see through the mist, probably is a little bit more than he's letting on.
Yeah.
He is keeping up with all the pop culture hits. If they have to go up to Olympus to ask for the quest in Chalice of the Gods, please let them be reading another book.
Right.
Like, and one that falls in line with the timeline.
Yeah.
So,
oh, no, I agree.
Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to think of timeline-wise where we might be, but it could be, like, Hunger Games or...
That's what I was
like
wondering.
Like, something like that, yeah.
And it's so interesting because... And I think this is still fine, but Rick purposely said that, like, he tries not to date these books too much because... He wants it to stay relevant throughout, you know, as kids find them again. And I think by not naming the books, like, you can kind of gloss over this, but, like, if you know, you know.
Right.
And I love stuff like that, so I got, like, so excited.
Oh, yeah. No, I glossed right past it. I wasn't paying attention. I was like, oh, he's reading. That's nice, you know. But it does give you a special little thrill.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he's reading New Moon. I wonder if he got to that one part. Just kidding. Okay, so yes, this gets us to the campers taking the elevator. They have to split into two groups. I think it's hilarious that you can fit 20 campers in the elevator in the Empire State Building. It's not a big elevator. I've been on it. 20 campers in there? That's a lot, Percy, but whatever.
And are they all in their armor? They are all in their armor and stuff. Oh my gosh.
It's a packed elevator, but they make it. I did love the note that the song has changed and that it's now Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees. I believe it's the Bee Gees.
Yeah.
Like, the gods don't always have a sense of humor, but the fact that they can, like, silly things like this. Like, I don't know who's responsible for choosing the elevator music up on Olympus.
Apollo?
But it's just funny. And I thoroughly appreciate it.
Speaking of silly little things, I just wanted to mention quickly that Annabeth talks about how Hera has been, like, low-key cursing her ever since they got into that argument, and basically been cursing her with cow patties. Like, she has to make sure she doesn't step on them, like, anywhere she goes, whether it's at home, in school, you know? So, not that Hera's really doing it as, you know, a funny ha-ha thing, but kind of stinks.
When it comes to curses, it's not the worst, but it's also kind of not
very annoying.
Okay, so now they are entering Olympus. They walk the streets, they get to the throne room, and there's nothing guarding it, which is definitely different compared to the last time they were up here, for sure. And so they walk right into the throne room, and there's really only two beings there. It's Hestia and the Ophiuchorus. And so Percy, you know, brief hi to Bessie, and then focuses on Hestia. And is about to, like, you know, he's there to ask her for an audience with Zeus. Like, he's there to say, like, we need to talk to Zeus and find out how we're going to guard Manhattan. But before he can even really say anything, Hestia stops him and says, you have the curse of Achilles. And Annabeth is like, what is she talking about? And he's like, later. And then this vision kind of starts.
Mm-hmm.
And the vision is obviously one of the bulkier parts of this chapter.
Right.
So it's worth looking at.
Yeah. Also, prophecy count number 26.
26.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. So yeah, Percy has a vision and he's looking back in time. He is looking at Talia and Luke meeting Annabeth for the first time. And you start to kind of wonder why this moment is like the thing that he has to keep in mind as one of his weaknesses. Because Hestia specifically says, like, Percy, now that you have this extra strength, now that you are carrying the curse of Achilles, you have to be very wary of your weaknesses because that's what ultimately could bring you down. And then she shows him a vision of Luke, Talia, and Annabeth.
Mm-hmm. So are they looking at Luke's weaknesses?
See, that's what I'm not sure of.
Yeah.
Is she showing him one of Luke's weaknesses, or is she showing him one of his own weaknesses? Like, seeing Luke and Annabeth's bond and seeing where, you know, that's kind of one of Percy's weaknesses is this jealousy he has over Annabeth and Luke's relationship. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if she's not giving him more information as to how that became a thing so that he maybe will be less threat. I don't know. Like, I don't know if she's trying to help him with this vision, like with just giving him information about Luke, or if she's trying to like help him see that what Annabeth and Luke have is different now. It may have been something for him to be jealous of if Luke hadn't turned. But the way Luke is now, Annabeth is not thinking the same way she used to. Like, she still has feelings and emotions tied to Luke, but I don't think it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. In this part of the vision, I definitely focused on just the fact that they, you know, call themselves a family, and then the knife specifically, too, yes. Because Percy notes, like, oh, he never really realized, like, where it came from, why she preferred fighting with daggers and stuff, and, like, I hope if nothing else, this makes Percy a little more empathetic to what Annabeth is going through, because they saved her life. They became her new family, and, like, this has to be crushing her to know that she's fighting Luke right now.
Well, and I'm pretty sure him handing her that knife and calling her clever and saying, only the bravest warriors fight with a knife. Like, these are probably the first time she's ever heard anything like mm-hmm. that in her life.
That's going to be very informative for her.
Prior to this, she's just been a burden on her family. The monsters are chasing her and she's trying to not let anybody she loves die. And, you know, she's a little estranged from her family because of all of that chaos. But like this, yeah, this is probably the first time she's heard anything good being said about what she is and the monsters that are chasing mm-hmm. her, and like, you know. So it's pivotal in her growing up and how she became the Annabeth we know now. And so, yeah, I definitely agree. The knife and the idea of being a dagger fighter, like the kind of fighter that would use a dagger, has really become a foundation of who Annabeth is.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke is responsible for that. Like, yeah. he introduced that to her world, so. Definitely significant, for sure. Okay, so then the vision changes, and it's Percy estimates maybe a week or two later,
mm-hmm.
they're definitely more of a trio. Like, yeah. they've been spending enough time together, aka every minute of the day, and they've bonded very quickly. And so they're running through the woods, and when they finally stop, they can see May Castellan's house. I'm almost picturing the exact place where they made camp that night. Percy and Nico and
yeah.
O'Leary.
That's
like,
true.
It's probably right there at that same spot, and they're looking down on the house, and, you know, we find out that, I think, is it Annabeth that's been injured or Talia? One of the girls has been injured,
mm-hmm.
and Luke's running in to get meds and food and, like, basically get them supplies so they can go find a new yeah. safe spot.
And this is
while.
Like the last place he wants to go. He does not want to go back to that house, but it's the closest and he's worried about them and they just got to get it done.
He mentions that all of their safe houses are burnt to a crisp. Like, they can't, there's nowhere else for them to go.
Right.
This is the last resort.
Yeah.
And before we can see another bit of it, there's this golden flash, which I interpreted as Hermes, like, official form.
Yeah.
Like, his godly form.
Yeah.
There's this golden flash, and then we hear a voice, and the voice says, you should not have come home.
Yeah.
So, not great.
Yeah, not ideal.
Not what you want to hear. And I love that in this chapter, we don't know who the voice is, but literally moments later, Percy hears it again, mm-hmm. and then Hermes shows up. So we very yeah. quickly get the answer that it was Hermes, who is Luke's father, and that, you know, like, it clears up that whole situation.
I just had a Star Wars flashback.
Right? You can't not. When yeah. you say Luke's father, it yeah. becomes this whole, yeah, it is. It just is.
Yeah, and Percy remembers that Luke had only met his father once, so it must have been in this moment, which explains why they do not have a good relationship. The first thing that comes out of his mouth is, you should not have come home. And I found this scene particularly interesting because we've talked before about, like, which gods we like more, which gods seemed a little more, like, normal or whatever. And the first time we meet Hermes on the beach in Sea of Monsters, he seems like an okay dude. Like, he feels bad about what's going on with Luke. He gives Percy gifts. He seems like kind of a funny guy. And as the god of, like, you know, tricksters and messengers, like, he's got a very interesting role, and he's always running around somewhere. But here, he's colder, he's scarier, and he blames Annabeth specifically for not saving Luke when she could have. And we don't really know what he's referring to, but no. Annabeth takes it very seriously. Like, she really takes it to heart.
Yeah. And they, like, she fires back, but not with, like, the vitriol that she could have. Like,
yeah.
She fires back. You can tell she has taken this blow and is like, well, what about you? Like, you're his dad. You could have done something.
Mm-hmm.
And then Percy, seeing Hermes getting mad at Annabeth, steps in and blasts Hermes with yeah. with all the blame
yeah.
because he wants to deflect it from Annabeth. Like, his brain is like, mm-hmm. I have to protect her. Like, I can't let Hermes yeah. get pissed. And Hermes almost blasts Percy into smithereens with his Caduceus and yeah. is very, very lucky that George and Martha speak to Hermes in that moment and say, hey, curse of Achilles. Like, yeah. let's not mess with that.
Yeah. I found this, again, really interesting because we've seen the other gods be very volatile. And I guess, like, I'm a little surprised to see Hermes like that because, again, when we met him, he was a little jovial. He was a little more human. You know, you could tell he empathized with what Percy was going through and he felt bad about Luke and all of that. But here he feels like a god, and that power is very interesting. And the way that he deflates after that, he's devastated by Luke's actions. He's sad about May's fate. Like, he still really cares about her. And it's just like, okay, like, these gods have a lot of emotions. And
yeah.
it's so interesting how it relates to the mortal world. Like, he's caring about mortals.
Mm-hmm.
About, like, I can understand him caring about Luke because he's a demigod. He's literally half of him. But May is still very much human. And yeah, he fell in love with her before. But, like, it's been a while. She's not who she was. I would kind of expect him to move on. But we've seen, even with Apollo later in the stories, like, they don't always, and Poseidon with Sally, like, they don't always move on all of the time. Like, they
yeah.
still have feelings for the mortals that they were with, and I find that very humanizing for them.
Agreed. And I think you kind of nailed it a little bit here with Hermes and the deflating. Like, he gets all puffed up and super godly.
He literally grows in size.
Right. Like, literally is ready to smite Percy down and just kill him and be done with it. And the George and Martha might bring him down, but, like, a second later, he deflates thinking about everything that's gone on with
mm-hmm.
Luke. And as they continue to kind of discuss Luke, he doesn't get as charged up again. Like, he just feels down about everything that's happened.
He feels very resigned.
Yeah. Okay, so, despite all of this, Hermes doesn't really fight them, but he does have a couple of messages to pass on.
Yeah.
We learn that Athena wanted to come herself, but she obviously is needed at the battle, at the battlefront.
Zeus won't let her leave.
Right. So, Hermes is sent to deliver the messages. So, A number one is they have to defend Manhattan themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The demigods are on their own.
Yeah.
Godspeed.
Bunch of children.
Good
defending
luck.
All of New York
40
City.
40 kids.
Yeah.
Have at it,
that's
guys.
Fine.
You can handle it.
They don't even have Chiron anymore. He went off to get more help, and who knows if he's coming back. And,
right. I mean,
yeah.
Mrs. O'Leary can help, but,
yeah.
you know, that's about it. The message number two is that Annabeth needs to enact Plan 23, and she makes it very clear that that Athena must think things are dire
yes.
in order to enact Plan 23.
Yeah.
Like, if she's calling this out.
Do you remember what Plan 23 is?
I remember at least part of Plan
23. Yeah, we probably remember the same part of that. Yeah. Which
yes.
is pretty cool. I'm actually excited to see this happen.
Yes, agreed. We quickly learn from Annabeth that Plan 23 does involve Daedalus's laptop
mm-hmm.
and or his inventions. We don't know exactly which ones or where they're at or any of that yet, but we know that there's going to be some chaos going
yeah.
on in Manhattan for sure. And then the third message is that Percy needs to remember the rivers,
mm-hmm.
which is very vague and
yeah.
totally helpful. Yeah. No, Percy has no idea what rivers she's talking
yeah.
about. Obviously, there's a couple of rivers that meet in Manhattan, but, like, Percy's not thinking about
yeah.
that right now.
He's like, does she mean the River Styx? Does she mean, you know, the Hudson River?
Right.
Like,
the East River?
Hudson?
Like,
yeah.
who is she talking about? Like, what rivers? Why rivers?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Why rivers?
Right. So, the messages are received, and Hermes leaves, mm-hmm. and then the Stoll brothers run up and are like, you guys have to come see this, and they run to this park on the edge of Olympus that has, like, the little viewing cam things, and all of the demigods are at these little view cam things looking down on the city of Manhattan, and they see that it's quiet, mm-hmm. silent, everyone is asleep on the ground, in the park benches, wherever they were, they just kind of fell asleep. And Percy quickly puts together Morpheus, Central Park, Grover. Morpheus has put the entire island of Manhattan to sleep.
Yeah.
It's clearly invasion time. Mm-hmm. So it's time to kick their defense into high gear.
Yes. Two things interesting about this. One, lucky that they were up in Olympus. Otherwise, they would have been put to sleep, too.
I mean, so, very true, very true. Yeah. I wonder if Chiron got
there. Yeah. Or did he... I think he went off elsewhere, but, like, where exactly was he going, you know? Yeah. And, like, is Mrs. O'Leary and Argus, are they asleep?
Right. Or the harpies that were driving the other two vans?
Yeah, exactly. Which was kind of a funny visual, by the way. That made me laugh. And also, the second thing is just that, again, we're now on Chapter 10... And the entire island is asleep. Like, this, the invasion is happening. This is happening now. We still have half the book left. So, this is a mountain that they're going to be climbing to get to the end.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole lot of book left to go. We've got a lot of story left to tell. And that, yeah, you're right. It's going to be chaos. Okay. So, that wraps up Chapter 9. We are just going to do our favorite quotes and memories. Favorite quotes and moments now. They're not memories yet. They're just moments, Kristen. Come on. Okay, so let's start with favorite quotes. I'll let you do yours because it came earlier in the
chapter. Yeah, it was pretty close. It was right when he was talking about being in New York City, being in the cab and on his way to the tunnel. Mrs. O'Leary was bounding behind him through traffic, and he goes, "Of course, the miss helped. People probably couldn't see Mrs. O'Leary, or maybe they thought she was a large, loud, very friendly truck." And I just... This is O'Leary.
I almost picked the quote right before that kind of started the chapter, because it was fairly witty, too, and I was like, Percy's just in rare form.
Yeah.
It was really cute. But instead, I went with Percy's quote about the Ares cabin, and he says, "The Ares cabin wasn't here, but I tried not to get too angry about that. Clarice was a stubborn idiot. End of story." And I felt very similarly. We've since talked about it, and maybe she had a point, but I'm still a little mad.
I also just really appreciated that he just moved on from it. Like, he was like, can't do anything about it. We just gotta attack what's in front of us.
Yeah, and I think he's hoping if we really need her later, hopefully she won't leave us standing. Like, right now, she's still making her point, but the fighting hasn't begun. So maybe she'll show up when we most need her. I think that's more or less what he's hoping for. Okay, and then when it comes to favorite moments, mine was just the visual of 20 campers and Percy riding in an elevator, listening to Stayin' Alive as they watch the numbers tick towards 600. And I can see it. And I'm like, when we get to season 5 of the TV show, like, I can't wait for this.
It's going to be so... I love those moments in, like, action movies and stuff when everything was just going nuts and they have to step into the elevator and it's just some crazy music and they're, like, you know, tapping their swords and, like, just looking around and not really talking, and it's like kind of awkward and like, oh, I find that so funny.
There's a scene like that in one of the Thor movies where he has to, like, it's in Dark World, where he has to get on the subway to get back to where he was because the little portal thing, like, sent him away. So he just, like, steps on with his hammer and is just waiting to get back to the fight. Like, I love that stuff.
Yeah, it's so good.
So yeah, this kind of fits that same thing, and the whole visual of it just got me. What was your favorite moment?
Mine was when Percy tries to take Hermes' attention away from Annabeth, all the while he's like, this is a dumb idea, but he's gonna do it anyway, and it didn't feel necessarily like, oh no, I have to protect Annabeth because she's weak, and, you know, like, it didn't feel like that. It was just like, he literally wasn't thinking. He was just like, don't yell at her.
Yeah.
Like, you got some issues you gotta deal with too, and he was like, this is really stupid, but I'm gonna keep doing it.
Yeah. No, I agree. It was more like, why are you yelling at her? Like, I'm not okay with that. It wasn't like, I must protect her. But, like, in his brain, it's like, he can't yell at her. Like, that's Annabeth. You know? Yeah. It's a whole thing. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram @Subjectify Media, or visit us at subjectivemedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts as well. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning in to Rewatchable, which has covered series like Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, and Angel, and many more. Most recently, we've also discussed all four Matrix movies. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that features our biggest hypes and gripes in fandom and life, and we even post interviews with our favorite creators. Lastly, we also have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has previously discussed every episode of the show, conducted many interviews with the cast and crew, and will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and that is a huge help for us. You can leave us questions and comments or ideas for episodes or content you might want to hear from us in any of these places, so please reach out. We do have two bits of feedback this week. I will let Karen take it away because they are from Twitter.
Yes, and they're both from Henry at CHB_cabin13. He says, in episode 54, I was surprised none of you guys guessed that the dog Rick was talking about making an appearance in the TV show might be Cerberus. I mean, it could just as easily be the poodle or the chihuahua too, just putting this out there. I think Cerberus comes later. Yeah. Which is why I was guessing it was a little too early for that. But it's still possible. Maybe they were looking at dogs to
right.
see, like,
which that could ones. Be. Well, because yeah. the other thing I was going to say is Cerberus is probably going to be CGI. So true. My brain didn't even give me the opportunity to yeah. think about it. Because he's got to be big. Yeah. Like Mrs. O'Leary big.
And the three heads.
Right. And plus, yeah. plus the three head thing. Yeah. Yeah. So, like, my brain just assumes it can't be because that's not going to be a real dog. But you're absolutely right. They could have been looking at dogs for like the form and yeah. to get the creature correct.
Dog auditions,
right?
I want to watch some dog auditions.
I am
auditions.
A dog casting agent. Yes, like, that's it. Just the dogs.
Henry also writes, also regarding that Luke Kronos Pharaoh's Blood host thingy, I want to say that Luke being part magician would be so interesting, but I did find this theory flawed because in the crossover stories, Percy hosted Nekbet, Egyptian goddess fighting against Setna, which, again, like, I totally forgot about all of that, so, like, I don't really remember. But, I mean, that's a fair point. If Percy was able to host them, then yeah. it doesn't necessarily have to be Egyptian blood. But, I mean, it would have been a cool tie yeah. to the other series.
And, I mean, we got an explanation that doesn't require the right. magician's blood, but it just would have been interesting and, yeah. and a fun way to tie them together.
Yeah.
So. Yep. Even if it was not perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, so next week is kind of a bit of a mystery as of right now. We're not entirely decided as to what we're talking about, but it'll be fun.
Yes.
And we'll definitely be doing chapter 10 of the book, and we will be covering the news. So we're not sure what the middle part is yet, but we'll get back to you yeah. on that.
Again, schedules slowly getting back to normal, and we'll be prepared next week and the following weeks with some ideas.
And this also means that we are kind of planning our next few episodes. So if anybody has any ideas for something you really want to hear us cover, right now is a great time to let yeah. us know. So please reach out if you have any really cool ideas that we haven't thought
yeah,
of yet.
Yeah, definitely.
But until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.